Our first speaker is Paola Casal, who is a reader in moral philosophy at Reading University and currently a research professor at the Universidad Pompeu Fabra in Barcelona. And we're very pleased to have her here to start us off. Paola.
Thank you. Well, first of all, I want to say that I think it's very strange that Philippe van Parijs is going to comment on me rather than the other way around. And looking at so many familiar faces in the audience, I think it's strange that you'll be listening to me rather than the other way around. But on the other hand, I have more reason than many of you to be here celebrating the career of Jerry Cohen. And that is because if Jerry hadn't had his brilliant philosophical career, I probably wouldn't have had any academic career at all. I would have remained a secretary or a math teacher as I was maybe for good. And that is because I was one of the many victims of the endogamic corruption of Spanish universities, where jobs are tailor-made for internal candidates and external candidates are put through absolute hell to get them to give up and leave the room for the other ones. So I had exhausted myself preparing for exams and interviews that the result of which was determined months in advance by the sort of powerful people controlling that area. And I had come very much close to giving up when Jerry Cohen, who rescues, as you know, a lot of things that other people discard, he decided to rescue me as well. So that's how I come to be here today. And there were some other people like David Miller and Hilles Steiner who also wrote essential door-opening references for me, but at the time Jerry did something else after what I had gone through I needed badly, which is he called me to All Souls and he actually read the reference to me. And of course that was incredibly painful because I very much wanted to become exactly the person that he was describing, and rationally even my desire not to let him down became even stronger than my desire not to be a secretary or a master. And it really worked like a magic wand on me. And then he had this very old typewriter that expressed his emphatic personality better than the computer, with all the periods and the commas perforating the paper. And he held the letter in his hand, like maybe he does with other writings, and said, "I believe every word of it, and I'm going to say it for as long as it takes until somebody listens." And for me, that was like, I don't know, drinking Asterix magic potion or something. I sort of started to believe that maybe there was a chance for me and maybe I could do this and that. And it really worked like a spell. No? Jerry said, "Paola, you are not a frog." And, I didn't stop being green and I didn't quite make it into a princess, but I became a shortlisted applicant that almost everything I applied, and so soon I had more jobs than I could take, and now that I've been offered a permanent research chair in Barcelona, of course, I am more grateful than ever before, and I really want Jerry's career to continue and to carry on writing books that create schools and open up new areas of debate for all of us. But I also, more selfishly, I want him to stay there like a protective figure in the background, without which I think I would feel very much again like an orphan. And, well, I want you to know that at least I'm going to be a very, very grateful orphan. So, thank you, Jerry.
How come you're going to criticize me?
I wonder when you decided to do that. Why would you do it? My English was terrible. I was always criticizing me. I had all these weird beliefs, like we were heading towards climate change and we shouldn't carry on as if we weren't. I was, why is he doing this? And, okay. I have had very few opportunities to praise his deeds, and he's right, the usual practice is criticizing his words, and so I'm going to go into that before I become more emotional.
The plan of the paper is this. I start with the egalitarian trilemma, and then I'm going to discuss Cohen's egalitarian ethos, problems that he has with his defense against the two roles and objections, problems of conflict between the two different replies he gives, and then I try to move him towards Mill's position. And then I start again and do the same with the roles and side, starting with the market maximizing ethos, the premises that defended and trying to find also areas of conflict and moving again to the middle position to end up to both ways in the sort of similar halfway position. I cannot skip a lot of sections in the paper because all the steps are needed, but I will just go faster over the more familiar areas, given that I can see in the audience almost everyone here is very familiar with it. So this is the representation of the dilemma. We might start with a situation where everybody gets paid the same per hour and we all freely choose our occupations, and then somebody discovers that if we attract some people to more productive occupations, then we're all going to do better. So we decide that the inequality is worth it for the sake of the gain, so we introduce inequality generating incentive payments. Mill, for example, commented that in the associations of working men in France, initially they start paying themselves by the hour, but soon after they realized that they were doing a lot better by paying by the piece. No? So the same problem can happen where the issue is to change people from one occupation to another or to increase productivity within one's occupation. Of course, there is another possibility, which is to force people to occupy these occupations and also force them to work harder, but then that would sacrifice freedom. So we have these choices, either preserve freedom and equality, or freedom and efficiency, or equality and efficiency. So the sort of standard roles and position is to say, well, the last option, D3, is intolerable because it involves sacrificing freedom, which we give lexical priority to, and the other one is irrational because it involves sort of leveling down or rejecting an inequality which was not detrimental to anybody, given that a lot of people gain and some people either gained something or didn't lose. Okay. Now, Jerry has a solution to the trilemma. Says we can have everything, freedom, equality and efficiency, if we introduce an egalitarian ethos that prohibits excessive self-seeking behavior in the market. That ethos involves compensation for labor burdens and also an agent sense of prerogative that permits us worrying about our own families and our own plans and projects and to a reasonable degree. So far he's winning. He's won the solve the trilemma. No. The Rosen had two objections. First, there is the priority of liberty. So they say, well, in fact, you haven't really solved the trilemma. What you have is you got rid of freedom, which we consider that in a society that has reached a certain level of development should have priority over further increases in income and wealth. So, in fact, justice prohibits the egalitarian ethos. And Jerry replies, no, I'm not, because this is only an ethos. I am not proposing that we conscript people and we send them to a factory in Omsk or Vladivostok, I'm not even proposing graduate taxes or a lump sum quantity that the talented can pay to buy the right to squander their talents later if they so wish. I'm not proposing any sort of coercion. People are just going to be convinced by my arguments and will endorse the egalitarian ethos. And that seems like a very plausible reply. For example, if we think of some people going to a job interview, and the job seems quite attractive, it involves going to nice restaurants and sampling delicious dishes and then writing a review, and then we ask them, why didn't you take them? And they say, well, it involved eating things which weren't kosher or halal or vegetarian. We don't think, oh, outrageous violation of occupational choice. In fact, we will think this is a very good example of a free choice that is made from reflective judgment and without coercion, just based on one's own convictions. So it seems like a very plausible reply. they launched the more complex basic structure objection, which says that the principles of justice apply to the major institutions of society and to legal coercion. They don't apply to individual actions or personal attitudes and beliefs. And so the objection is not that the ethos is prohibited, but that is not required by a theory of justice which is meant to apply to the basic structure. And Jerry Gans gives an extremely plausible reply. He says, think about a sexist ethos that dictates that we're going to give all the occupational opportunities to boys and get the girls to help their mothers with the house chores. That is going to have effects which are also profoundly influential and present from the start. And the fact that there is no legal backing for it doesn't seem to be a good reason. Sometimes the Rawlsons talk about the basic structure emphasizing the legal aspects, and other times is, you know, the rationale for focusing on there, the profundity of the effects that matters, and that is more plausible and leads to a more expansive conception of the basic structure and is the one that they should take, but then they would lose this possible reply to their resolution, the egalitarian ethos. So far it looks like, you know, he is, you know, winning every round. But there's a problem with the two replies. So the first reply, he's saying, the egalitarian ethos involves no conflict at all with liberty because it's only an ethos. So there is no legal coercion, there's no other form of coercion, there is no conflict at all. And when he's replying to the basic structure objection, he's saying, just because the sexist ethos is only an ethos, that doesn't mean it could be just as influential and oppressive and unjust as another practice which is legally backed. So, you know, on the one hand, he's using one conception of the basic structure, and the other one is using the other one, and seems to be saying that the principles of justice apply and do not apply to beyond the legal structure to an ethos. So, how do we solve this problem? Because I don't think this is just a problem for Jerry, it's a problem for anybody who, like me initially, found both replies very, very plausible, but didn't have a way of reconciling them. So I started looking at various ways out. And the first one was to accept that different principles are going to have a different scope. And initially, this idea seemed plausible because given that the principle of justice has lexical priority, you think, well, if it's going to have lexical priority and then it's going to have unlimited scope, there is not going to leave much room for other considerations to play an important role in our decision making. So maybe the principle of liberty is going to be focused on legal restrictions, and maybe some people think this is a principle that is supposed to protect the individual against the state, so it makes sense that it focuses on legal coercion, while the difference principle is a principle of distribution of benefits and burdens. So other factors which are going to be profoundly influential in that distribution would be taken into account. So if he was going to take that option, then he should have focused his critique on how extremely influential can be having an egalitarian ethos or a market-maximizing ethos. No, we see there are big differences between the Scandinavians and the United States, or, you know, or the Cubans or other countries because of the different ethos they have, among other things. But he didn't. He went to question the distinction between the formal and informal aspects of the basic structure. And what matters the most is that I think he was right to go in that direction. Imagine that, as it happened in many cases, there is a society that prohibits women from driving cars or having bank accounts or walking in the streets by themselves. And through international pressure, they end up cancelling those laws. But as a matter of fact, any woman who engages in these activities is seen as dangerous and defiant, as planning adultery, as lacking protective male relatives, and in fact, they end up not doing any of these things just like when there was legal coercion. So I think he was very right to raise this this issue and question this sharp distinction between something that is legally bad and something that, that is not. So I think we need to abandon this possibility. Okay, the second one is to distinguish souls and sanctions and mere beliefs. So he could say that a sexist ethos involves social sanctions, but the egalitarian ethos is not going to involve any sanction, and so it's not going to be coercive. So this, the first moral problem is that it's sociologically unrealistic that an ethos would become as extremely widespread as it would have to reach the level of equality that he thinks that ethos could take us without any form of social sanction. And if somehow it did happen and it became completely widespread, it would be impossible that social pressure or condemnation wouldn't take place when a minority of people fall short of the demands of the egalitarian ethos. Then there is the problem of this assumption that a mere belief cannot restrict freedom, and I think that isn't true either. The thing about the Iraqis that the American soldiers made prisoners and they strapped with wires and they were told to stay like this without moving, because if they move they were going to be electrocuted, and they stay without moving for hours and they were prisoners, and in fact there was no electrical connection. I think these people were prisoners and they were completely free, even though, you know, it was just the belief that that they had that rendered them unfree. So, you know, in fact, spreading false beliefs about the horrific things that would happen if you do certain things is one of the most effective ways of getting people not to perform certain actions, as a lot of religions know. The final thing is that I think even if there were no sanctions, a sexist ethos would still be objectionable. Imagine a society where women have this maternity ethos and they think women should be entirely devoted to procreation, and that parliaments and courtrooms are no places for them to enter, and the daughters just imitate the mother's behavior, and compliance is so widespread that sanctions are not even necessary. I wouldn't say that this is a society that fully satisfy the lexical priority of you know, civil liberties and fair equality of opportunity. You know, I think all of us more likely to side with Mill, who said, when society is itself a tyrant, it practices a social tyranny more formidable than many kinds of political oppression, since it leaves fewer means of escape, penetrating much more deeply into the details of life and enslaving the soul itself. So I think this second solution should also be abandoned. So then comes one final possibility, which is to think that a sexist ethos constrains, but a just ethos wouldn't constrain. And Jerry gives some examples in his book in that direction, comparing the egalitarian ethos to prohibition against committing evil crimes. I mean, the first thing is an obvious but I think solvable problem of circularity. You know, he would be saying, the egalitarian ethos doesn't conflict with liberty because it's just. And why is it just? Well, among other things, because it doesn't conflict with liberty. So he would have to rephrase this defense by saying, if I have successfully proven through independent arguments that this is really a just ethos, then there wouldn't be a problem with liberty. So I think the circularity objection is solvable, but there are other problems with this possible solution. One is that he himself thinks and says so quite clearly in the book that there are big differences between murder or child abuse or other crimes and the egalitarian ethos. He would be totally in favor of punishment for these crimes, and he, you know, gives a lot of reasons that Cecil will discuss later against conscription or coercion of any sort in the direction of the egalitarian ethos. So he thinks that they are different. And also, when we have prohibitions against essentially evil crimes, we could say things like, we are not being deprived of anything valuable, or is a restriction that we have no reason to regret. But in the case of other just rules, which could involve restrictions on traveling, for example, is something that is valuable, like traveling an innocent, which combined with the actions of many other people through some complex mechanism leads to climate change. So there's a difference between a prohibition on something which is essentially evil and other just prohibitions, and the egalitarian ethos would not be of the sort that we couldn't say we have been deprived of something valuable, or this is a restriction we have no reason to regret, because occupational choices are something very valuable. And then other problems that happen with this is that, so take the example of the campaigners against arranged marriage, which say that, you know, who a woman decides to marry or have sex with should be like her personal area of freedom, and it should be free from all sorts of pressure, including moral pressure. Well, that wouldn't make any sense if, you know, moral pressure would only render us free. And in fact, what would be interested in articulating morality to include the sort of vocational oasis from duty, including the agent-centric prerogative that Jerry himself defends, with words like, we are not nothing but slaves to social justice. So that is quite a strange thing to say of an ethos that you're also saying that it leaves liberty completely intact. No? So they, it wouldn't make you a complete slave to social justice. And the other problem I have with this view is the case of not organizing morality but a society in order to create areas of freedom. There would be a lot of people that if the state didn't help us look after our children or all relatives, we would be, you know, completely devoted all day to looking after one and the others, and we wouldn't have any opportunity to develop our careers or do other things. And I think that is a good reason to create these areas of space for individuals and free them from these obligations. And if just following your moral obligation left you completely free, then we would lose this argument for arranging things in a way that it maximizes these areas of freedom for the individual. And the final problem is that imagine that somehow it does happen that everybody in the society autonomously develop a complete conviction that the egalitarian ethos is true, and the egalitarian ethos is in fact true, and they move by this conviction, they don't suffer crazy or anything, they follow it. The million problem will come back again, because if that is happening, the social function and the disapproval for people who might occasionally fail to comply with the demands of the egalitarian ethos are going to come back. And Jerry is worried about legal coercion and other forms of coercion, even if the explanation or the reason why the individuals are acting is conviction, the fact that if they didn't, they would be, you know, sent to prison or punished in some way, that would already be something he would oppose, even if the reason for the behavior is the conviction. So taking that line, in fact, wouldn't solve the million problem. So I think we should, you know, move to the million view. So Mill, on some aspects, agrees with Cohen, and in others agrees with Walls. No? Like Jerry, he considers incentive payments unjust, and like Rawls, thinks that an ethos and public opinion can't restrict freedom. And then he distinguishes three types of activity. There is other regarding activity punishable by law, like when you commit a crime. There is the other regarding activity punishable by opinion. And then there is the self-regarding activity, which is immune to either type of punishment. So cases like a gay marriage or interracial marriage, these people should not be criticized or pressurized, should be just left to do their thing. But in other cases where you might engage in an activity which is hurtful to others or wanting due consideration of their welfare and has important effects on these other people, then society has jurisdiction over that area and you might be justly punished by opinion. And I think that this division in three options rather than two is more plausible and it fits with a lot of other practices and convictions. The one that Mill mentions is that of the men who decide to abandon their wives and children. He says that there should be the legal right to divorce, but on the other hand, an ethos of responsibility and public opinion should get these people to think very carefully about the enormous implications for all of these people or what they are going to do when they leave their families. So even if you allow them legally to leave, it is appropriate that opinion would deal with this matter as well. So his response suggests a possibility which almost seemed like the most plausible way of dealing with the trilemma for me, which is to say an ethos might restrict freedom, but it might do so legitimately. And we should balance freedom with the other considerations. No? When we have three values and we agree that there is value in the three of them, I think the normal thing is not to say, well, I pick these two or these two and abandon the other one completely. The sensible thing is to say, well, let's see what little adjustment we can do here and there and what restriction here is justified by the gains in the other area and make adjustments trying to rescue what we all think is valuable. So that would give rise to an intermediate position between Rawls and Cohen more uncompromising views. I mean, Jerry is usually seen already as extreme and uncompromising, partly because of the texts about the strict and the lax different principle, and partly because he is a little bit sort of out of line with the mainstream, and partly maybe because of some particular examples, you know, like he compares the talented with kidnappers that do not want to give back the child unless they receive this money that they request. And of course, this is a very powerful example, but no one that naturally lends itself to thinking, well, maybe we should balance the interest of the kidnapper with the those of the child and the family. No? But the Rawlsian position, which creates a sharp distinction between the market and the forum, and there is very different behavior for the forum where we are selecting mutually binding public rules, and in the market where we are free to pursue our plans and shop around for whatever accords best with our preferences, it is also quite an extreme and uncompromising position. And I give some examples that seem plausible to me. First, take the case of pilots' strike, which, you know, coming from Spain is a problem we suffer very often, and the other Spaniards in the audience can confirm the problem we've been having even last week with that. The pilots go on strike and demand higher wages. As a result, they have to make adjustments in the company, and less essential staff like cleaners and luggage handlers and people lower down in the hierarchy either have their wages reduced or sometimes they're made redundant to make room for these other payments. So whenever these people who already are so rich and they have their vocation and they have everything go on strike, there's a lot of other people that are much worse off and suffer as a result of that. And I think, you know, they should have an ethos of self-restraint and not carry on making more demands just because they are able to. And some people will say, oh, well, this is just an issue of income. But the difficult one is when occupational choice is at stake. So think about another case, like I thought about a case of an workaholic economist called Amartya, who has these two activities. Either he can do this very socially useful research on famine, which might save a lot of lives for people who are desperate, and he has a very slight preference for more esoteric discussions about some
philosophical issues which are fun, but the social implication of that activity isn't that clear that it would yield some dividends. On his view, just because he had this fancy, slightly more entertaining to talk about these other philosophical issues, then there would be nothing wrong for, if he requested exorbitant sums for the completion of his research on famine, or if he abandoned both research on famine and philosophical discussions for something which was intellectually worthless and socially useless, but extremely well paid. And I also find that this view is too extreme and implausible. Well, now think about another case which I have started to think because of Adam's book. Some people might say the problem is not with incentives, it's that with the inequalities that usually come as a result of incentives, because something very innocent, which we don't have good reason to criticize, for example, spending time with our children, reading them bedtime stories and teaching them the things that we know, might result in very large class inequalities and enormous differences in opportunities in life. So think about a case like an island that has failed to establish a monetary economy. So incentive payments can only be paid in perishable goods. So no inequality would result from the practice of incentive payments. My eldest son is a great surgeon who says, well, when I was in the mainland, yeah, I used to make so much money by being a surgeon that it was worth it for me. But in this island, you know, what you can, for the stuff that you can get here, I just rather, you know, use the scalpel to carve wood or do something else. No? So supposing that the other doctors in the island are already overworked or they don't have his ability, the people in this island have to, you know, climb cliffs looking for plover's eggs, they have to dive in unsafe waters looking for oysters, they have to find him for days to get this guy to perform the operation. So because they're all perishable goods, in the end there would be no inequality, and also they he wouldn't have accumulated something that would put him in a position where he can reject further work because he has already accumulated an amount of wealth. No? But I still find this thing very extreme and objectionable. Also, once we have come to the conclusion that an ethos or social pressure really constrains, then if we defend this extreme view that both Amartya and the pilots and the doctors, you know, should be protected, and they can do whatever they like, and ask for the money that they can get, then we would have to also be against the social pressure and criticism. And I find this very implausible. In the other cases that Mill considers, like gay or interracial marriage, I agree that, you know, maybe considerable resources should be devoted to the protection of these people so that they are left alone. But the idea that you know, justice requires, you know, protecting these high flyers from criticism seems really bizarre. Mm-hmm. So I think this requires a defense, right? So let's look at some plausible premises that for some people do support this uncompromising position. The first one is the claim that occupational choice is special, that we have very greater interest in it. I completely agree with this. You know, being told, you know, what would you like to be in life is one of the deepest, most important questions you can be asked. And it can, you know, make all the difference between a life of flourishing and fulfillment and one of failure and frustration. It involves, you know, thinking about your abilities, your values, your ambitions, so many things that I think it is fair to compare to the case of marriage, which is something that you should be deciding away from all sorts of pressure. So this seems a plausible idea. The second is that when you have reached a certain level of material comfort, then you should be giving priority to this, which we have already established is very important for human beings, over further increases in wealth. And the final one is that some occupational choice should be protected not only from legal restrictions, but other sanctions which can render opportunities
de facto unavailable, even if they are, the opportunities are de jure intact. And I think all the feminist examples confirm that this position makes sense, that restrict, you know, having a view that only focuses on a legal restriction isn't appropriate. But the problem is that though I find all of this plausible, I think for me it leads to a different conclusion. I think if occupational choice is so important for human beings, then it should not remain the exclusive privilege of a fortunate few. We should think about the occupational choice of the cleaners and the ladder climbers and not just the pilots. And if it matters more than material gains, then we cannot say that, oh, but giving more opportunities to these luggage handlers would cost us money, we might have to create evening classes or start a business loans or something like that. I don't think that would be a good argument after you have said that this thing is so important for human beings that you shouldn't privilege further increases in income and wealth over the provision of occupational choice. And finally, if the pilot's choice has to be protected even from the subtle pressure of moral criticism, then the cleaner's choices should be protected from restrictions which are much firmer and make them, you know, far more free. If these people didn't come home completely exhausted and without any income, they might have opportunities for looking for other solutions. Going through salsa, I've met a lot of people like that who have horrible jobs, and they require years and years to be able to turn their passion for dancing into a new profession, or some people who might save and develop a stained glass workshop in their back garden and eventually manage to turn this into their full-time occupation. The more you make, the more, and the worse you pay them, you know, they might take so many years. Some of my friends have taken so long to make it into a dancer that by the time they got the dance studio, they weren't fit to dance anymore. No? And I think, you know, it is partly because of the demands of the other people higher up in these companies that they have had such bad opportunities of income and time. So, of course, the option, the way of stopping the direction in which I'm going would be to say, oh, well, but the cleaners and the luggage handlers are legally free. They're not slaves. They can just go and take some other occupation. And the restrictions on freedom that do count are legal restrictions. Because then, when we're talking about the pilots and when we're talking about the cleaners, we would be saying very different things, and we would be engaging in a strategic contradiction similar to the one we saw earlier. No, at one point we're emphasizing legal coercion, on the other time we are taking a much more expansive conception of the basic structure and the coercions that that really count. So I think the Protestants are going to have now a similar problem to the one Jerry had. So I think this is the direction that they should go, emphasize real occupational choice. And I will skip the section on the text that I think support the interpretation of liberty in this direction as real liberty or the fair value of liberty. And just move to the solution. Well, take the case of men and women once more. Traditionally, men have had unrestricted occupational choice, free from childcare and house duties. They could do everything they wanted, and women have had very little at all. I don't think that the Protestants could be happy with this situation, and they would agree to a number of changes that would equalize this situation. Some things would involve changes like subsidies, for example, subsidize childcare or subsidize evening classes or other types of subsidies that would allow people to remake their lives and take new directions and gain some occupational freedom. Other times there would be restrictions, no? Restrictions on the length of a working week, for example, or restrictions on how many jobs can somebody had. I think they are legal restrictions, but they are perfectly legitimate, and they would have an enormous impact on the occupational opportunities of those who have list. And some, well, once we have come to this position, some will say, oh well, so let's just maximize the real occupational freedom of in society, and I don't see that this is not within the range of the roles and positions. It's still very far from Jerry's egalitarian ethos, because you are just recommending some basic structural changes to maximize free occupational choice. It's still very much focused on the priority of occupational choice over further increases in income and wealth. So that isn't really a halfway position. It is more on the roles and side. But then I think, well, what about introducing an ethos as well? And I think there are good reasons for this. First of all, there's nothing wrong with an ethos. No, Rawls himself proposed tempering the legal right to free speech with a duty of civility. And it doesn't have to involve any monism. No? What Fogg uses the word to refer to people who think there would be no distinction between the market and the forum. Even if in the ethos you have not only the egalitarian element, but also a concern with the basic freedom and with occupational choice, you still you can have differences in the application. Can be one can be less demanding. There could be different ways of applying it, so it doesn't have to deny that there is a difference between selecting mutually binding public rules or acting in your own life. And second, I think this can be essential. I mean, work to rules, as the one we had with the pilot lately, they can make a whole system collapse. And just having the right ethos can sometimes allow you to adopt better structures, and sometimes can change the impact of the basic structural reforms that you introduce. Sean Harvard Hibbs, for example, examined a number of practices that the Japanese developed, and they were extremely successful, and the Americans wanted to copy this because they wanted to increase productivity, but because they didn't have the same face-to-face relations, they ran into terrible problems of trust, and the Americans ended up being trapped in a prisoner's dilemma, so that they couldn't adopt any of this structure because they lacked the right ethos. And in other cases, if we introduce basic income, for example, or basic minimum, or other measures like paternity leave for men, depending on the ethos, these measures are going to have a very different impact. No? It could be that sort of salary for housewives make being a housewife more attractive, instead of allowing women to break out of the situation and start developing a profession. No? The same with basic income. No, it could allow people to have much more freedom, much more possibilities of starting new lives and being free from lots of constraints. But it can also, you know, with other attitude, just leave people stuck in that situation, just living on basic income and not doing very much more with their lives. So I think the ethos can be essential, can make an enormous difference, and it's not a good idea to leave it outside political morality. Then I also think that there are many examples of cases which can justify or can satisfy publicity requirements. For example, the view that you shouldn't be threatening to leave the country whenever they announce that there is going to be some more progressive taxation, or an ethos about certain occupations that provide essential services like doctors, to have some restrictions, as Daniels has explained in some articles, on the kind of strikes that they can engage in general, for people who have professions like ours, which are creative, high status, free hours, you know, got everything. You know, I don't see the justification for carrying on going on strikes to make further demands for income. And there are lots of cases where we can define the ethos and the rules in a way that they satisfy the publicity requirements, which in any way, after we have adopted this position, and we wouldn't have a very extreme egalitarian ethos, but some more moderate position, I don't think that they would be also that essential to satisfy them to this publicity requirement to a high degree. And the final point is that I think even if we are focused on occupational choice, the ethos is going to be broadly very egalitarian. The reason for that is, first of all, like Bill said, and I won't read this entire quote because I want to finish in time. Poverty is the main cause of occupational unfreedom. And these two articles that I put there are contemporary and very detailed studies that confirm that Mill was right in his debate with Adam Smith, that it isn't true that when a job is hazardous or involves various undesirable features, it would be paid better. In fact, these jobs are the worst in every respect. The second article defines 14 features of job desirability. Women's jobs have 12 of those 14, and differences in income and wealth are in fact quite small compared to overall differences in job desirability. For example, even in places where there's only a 20-something percent difference in income between men and women, according to this criteria, the difference is 2.1. So men's jobs are more than twice as good as women's jobs. And the jobs which are hazardous, the jobs which are taken by the more desperate section of the population, have all of the bad features. They are jobs that they are designed in order to be able to hire people who are less qualified, and so they would start with a very low income. And so whenever compensation you have to give them for the risk of losing a limb or being poisoned or something, they will still leave you at a very low low level. If you had to compensate a professor for the risk of losing a limb or getting poisoned by some gas, then the level of compensation would have to be enormous. And that gives employers a strong incentive to break down jobs and reorganize things so that some tasks are given to some people who have the lowest skill, and they are given a book of rules that they have to follow. There is no discretion. They don't learn anything on the job. These jobs have no job security. The employers don't want to have any connection with people who might be poisoned and develop diseases later. They want them out and with no connection to the company as soon as possible. So the organization of jobs, and not just the equal opportunity to get these jobs, but the way the jobs have been constructed, they are accumulating all the worst features of repetitiveness and low workers' autonomy, no job security, etc. All the bad features go into one side, and the good ones going to the other one. So I think we would have to do some work at reorganizing this, because the sort of opportunity, like Brian Barrett would say, resuffering babies in the hospital in a very unequal society, and then say there's this equality of opportunity, is not enough. We have to do something about this, the way that the jobs have been created, so that some people have all of the features of job disability and other people have none. But I think that now I have found a solution. And that, in fact, I think it's extremely unlikely that we will ever have a pilot strike again. And that is because there's been a change in the leadership. And now that there's been taken over by this new group with Jack, John, and Jerry at the helm, or the joystick, it's all going to be plain sailing or flying from now on, because I completely agree with the a slogan of their campaign, which is no trilemma, too trying for this trio. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Paola. So, Philippe is going to give a comment. This is Philippe Van Parijs, who, like everybody else at this conference, needs no introduction.
Right, so I have to comment on Casal, on Cohen, on Rawls, on Mill. I love Mill, I love Rawls, I love Paola, and need I say, I love Jerry for reasons analogous to those movingly expressed by Paola at the beginning of her intervention, but also in his more sober style by David. Jerry, there is probably no single individual who's exercised a greater influence on the style of my thinking than Jerry, on the unachievable standards I had to set myself in a way analogous to
to Paola. I should also say that beyond that, probably goes beyond the intellectual, and certainly until my last breath, unless Alzheimer hits too badly, I'll remember a number of more personal conversations with Jerry, from one memorable, particularly frank, on a bench in a square in Madrid. That was when I first met Paola as well.
To that one February 1990.
To one far more recently, at the Cowley Road bus stop, when Jerry recited to me a poem, and we left each other, and I caught the bus with both tears in our eyes. So Jerry has meant a lot to me, and as have some of the other chaps there. And so with all these lovely people around, it should have been a pleasure to comment on this paper. But it was not, and I suffered while preparing this comment because of some very uncomfortable substantive interference with a business I unexpectedly had to devote much time to this week. I shall briefly, and I'll return to that at the very end, I shall briefly present this business in a stylized, exaggerated, and transposed format. Let's suppose, Paola, that you are asked to stand for rector of Pompeo Fabra University. You say, no way, on the ground that you don't have all the qualities required, but you also think, that's basically why you say no, that you couldn't care about all these sleepless nights about deficits of university hospitals and spending days shaking hands at degree ceremonies and all that, instead of enjoying the company of a number of people you've met through the years at a conference in honor of your former supervisor and many other activities you think of in the formal and informal sphere which you would have to give up in case you accepted to stand for rector of Pompeo Fabra. And then comes the election or the election period, and it turns out that there are only two candidates who people feel are really not up to the job, partly because they are not experienced. In fact, everyone believes they are far less up to the job than would have been, including the one you encouraged to stand at the very last minute. So what's the connection with our trilemma and with the topic of this paper? Here is one suggestion, quite plausible. Whoever of the two candidates will when perhaps things will go so badly that quite plausibly, as some people have already suggested, next time it will be decided to double or treble the rector's salary and to invite outsiders to apply. Inequality will unambiguously increase in your university community and in Spanish society, not just the pilots who will get high wages, but also the rectors. And you'll say, well, it's not my fault, you didn't get a pay rise, you didn't ask for a pay rise, indeed you would not have done the job even if it was paid 10 times what it is paid now, and yet it's because of people like you who prefer to indulge in philosophizing or metaphysics, whatever, like the Amartya you mentioned before. It's because of people like you who prefer to indulge in all that than to serve their community that inequality has received yet another boost. So should you feel bad about that? And what should you do about it? So this question kept coming to my mind as I was reflecting on your paper, indeed rereading some of the stuff Jerry wrote about it, and I'll return to it at the very end, but obviously there will be a number of connections which I leave implicit all the way. Let me quickly then go, because you made such a nice synthesis, so I won't need to re-summarize the paper, but let's start with the initial problem, the trilemma. We have to reconcile somehow equality, liberty, efficiency. Some people say it's not possible. Efficiency is here understood simply, say, as pari to optimality. Liberty is understood as freedom of occupational choice, because I'll return to that in a minute. And then equality can be understood in a more or less subtle way, and of course, as you define it in a more subtle way, the sharpness of the trilemma decreases. If you define just as equality of incomes, the trilemma will be sharper than if you say it's equality of earnings per hour, or if you define it as Jerry does in terms of something like burden income bundles. But even if you define it as in this very more subtle way, the question ultimately there remains a trilemma, essentially because some people have, in a very broad sense, some talents, that is, they happen to have some qualities, some dispositions, some qualifications that make them particularly suitable to fill some particularly valuable jobs, which they may find less attractive than some other activities they are also able to do. And the question is, well, these inequalities that will then remain in order to preserve liberty and efficiency, are they just? The Rawlsian answer to that question is, and or the lax interpretation of difference principle, is that we shouldn't in fact bother with all this refining the notion of burdens and all that. We just allow any equality of income, wealth and powers that is required to maximize in a sustainable way, or at least that is compatible with maximizing in a sustainable way the expectation of the worst off category. Can we give another answer to this same question about whether it's just to give these incentives to the talented? In other words, can we sensibly move to the left of Rawls? Yes, we can. Cohen's answer to this question, Jerry answered to this question with the strict interpretation of the difference principle. Let's be careful, he says, about what require means here, or compatible in the weaker formulation. Equality is, equality suitably defined, is perfectly compatible, or at least massively more compatible with efficiency and consistent with freedom of occupational choice, providing people are committed to an egalitarian ethos. Okay, then you have the two Rawlsian Rawls-spirited objections. Jerry, have you not given up liberty? And Jerry says, no, why should I give liberty if people are moved by their convictions, by their ethical views? Second Rawlsian attack, Jerry, the principles of justice should apply only to the basic structure. Jerry says, come on, Paula says very plausibly, the basic structure surely is not just a legal structure. And Mill is on your side on that. So there are all these pressures, sanctions that go beyond the pure legal framework. But strategic contradiction in the phrase used by Jerry and taken over by Paula, essentially, I mean, to put it too simple a way, if this ethos is really can be made of the basic structure, then in some sense, even possibly in a more subtle way than the legal structure, and Jerry has various paragraphs on that at the end of the How Come You Are So Rich book. So, in a more subtle sense, it restricts freedom. So if it's part of the basic structure, and structure is more important here than basic, then there is some sort of some restriction of freedom in a sense then that matters. Then Paula examined and criticized a number of responses, three responses that try to save the idea that the egalitarian ethos does not restrict the freedom of occupational choice in a sense that matters. Paula says, rightly, I think, that none of these responses is satisfactory, and she takes then another track. And that's then what I'll quickly then concentrate on in the rest of what of my brief comment. That other track consists in admitting that an egalitarian ethos restricts, and possibly seriously restricts, the freedom of occupational choice in a sense that matters. But she adds, so bloody what? All of us have our real freedom of occupational choice massively limited. simply by virtue of the limits on our capacities. We could not get some jobs at all because we lacked the skills, we lacked the talents, and we could not exercise some activities we would like to exercise and could. We have the skills for them, but we can't, simply because those activities would not pay enough, would not be able to make ends meet consistent with also the fulfillment of some other obligations we have, possibly care obligations. So all of us have our freedom of occupational choice massively restricted, and some of us, of course, far more seriously than others. So that was also the last quote and the last references. Some of us are restricted by these very constraints, including some constraints that come from these care obligations, but the skill limitations and where they live and so on. Some of us are restricted to a small range of lousy, boring, despised jobs, moreover badly paid. Let's therefore not make too much fuss about the egalitarian ethos restricting somewhat the wide range of occupational choice, the considerable leeway for pay bargaining, whether individual or collective, of those best equipped, if this enables us to widen the range of occupational choice of those with the narrowest range, typically by redistributing more. Can be redistribution within a firm. If you need to pay less the high flyers, you may be able to do some sort of redistribution within the firm. If it's sufficiently big, sufficiently monopolistic firm, not so constrained by the market, you may be able to do so. Of course, you can do so in state firm, but it will take mostly the form of formal redistribution by public institutions in form of subsidies to unskilled jobs, for example, or subsidies to training for people who are unskilled in the form of childcare support, or indeed in the form of a universal basic income, whose main virtue is, of course, not to enable the least disadvantaged to remain inactive, but precisely to broaden the range of activities they can choose from while making ends meet and fulfilling their obligations, and at the same time to strengthen their bargaining power in such a way that they can improve the various non-pecuniary features of the jobs they occupy. So the outcome, so if you do this, so you start from the trilemma, and then you say, well, why do we care so much about this freedom of occupational choice as traditionally defined? I mean, is the freedom of occupational choice not massively restricted anyway for most of us and very unequally? So once you do that, where do you end up? Obviously, the neat trilemma has evaporated because the freedom of occupational choice is no longer a constraint, but it's a matter of degree, indeed of hugely unequal degree for the different members of our society. The occupational choice is still there, it's important, but it's rather part of the distribuendum. It has become part of the distribuendum about which there can, of course, still be a significant trade-off between equality and efficiency. An appropriate ethos can soften this trade-off, can make the legal arrangement that maximizes occupational choices, or the range of occupational choices for the worse off, both better for the worse off and more egalitarian, but, and this will then be part of one of my three final questions, but it's... Sorry? Okay. It helps, huh? Right, and the ethos will help, but this ethos can be in part an egalitarian ethos, but we could see also from some of Paula's remark that it doesn't need to be only an egalitarian ethos. It can also be a work ethos, for example, because the high-skilled workers work for the sake of working rather than for the sake of the net earnings they'll get out of the earnings, the more we'll be able to tax them, so that without any negative impact on the supply of their labor or the intensity of their labor. It can also take the form of a community spirit, It's because of solidarity between people in the same neighborhood that the people look after each other's children, so that some people, as the example has just been given as we were entering the buildings, that some people can attend this conference because they can rely on people in their neighborhood looking after their children while they are away. So it's an ethos of community spirit, not immediately focused on anything like an egalitarian ethos. And it can also take the form, thinking of it by listening to various speeches by Obama, take the form of a patriotic ethos. Patriotic can be at the level of a particular organization, maybe people devoting themselves to their community, their university community, for example, by accepting to become a rector. Or it can be people simply accepting to stand for elections, to become prime minister of a country. And I can tell you, in some countries, it's an awful job, it's a terrible job. How can you find people to do this, that sort of thing? So the patriotic ethos is also something that gives you more leeway in terms of how egalitarian the end result will be, because the more you have this spirit, the more people will be willing to commit themselves to serving their country, and don't ask what your country can do for you, blah, blah, blah. But also, more people will want to stay there, within their organization or within their country, even though they are taxed there, not paid that much, but because of some sort of commitment. So it's not just an egalitarian ethos that may help you reduce the trade-off, make the trade-off less sharp between efficiency and equality. So this leads me then to close to three questions. In a way, what I've just suggested is a sort of straightforward extension of the Mill-Casal approach. So we need to feminize the pilot the profession there a little bit. So you say, following Mill, that both types of sanctions, that is, the legal sanctions and then the ethos, ethical sanctions in this sense, so the moral pressure, social pressure exercised by people you care about, that both types of sanctions can be effective methods for achieving compliance with the norm, and that this compliance with this norm will enable you to combine to a greater extent efficiency and to better combine concern for efficiency and concern for equality. This is all fine and highly congenial to me, indeed, as I briefly alluded to it. What made me embark on my whole universal basic income odyssey, 25 years, a long time ago, was precisely the indignation with some people who had great jobs, well paid, interesting in themselves, who wanted to oblige other people to do lousy jobs which they would never have dreamt to do themselves, but to which these people were confined. So, therefore, the whole approach, this alternative to the trilemma thinking, is very congenial to me. But I have three questions. The first question is, do you agree that we should rely on not only on this, on a specifically egalitarian ethos, which is often very hard to sort of get clear implications from because of the fuzziness of the concept of burden. As soon as you have a sort of a more subtle notion of equality that doesn't just say equality of incomes, but equality of burden income bundles. And of course, we know that what's experienced as a burden by some, I don't know, maybe shaking hands at degree ceremonies also may be enjoyed by it. So you have all these problems abundantly discussed, including by Jerry in his work about this notion of burden. And so the egalitarian ethos obviously is not very clear in what it instructs us to do. So the first question is, should we not go with equal enthusiasm and scrutiny plus for these complementary and partly overlapping ethe, or however, whatever the plural of ethos is, an ethos of work, an ethos of community spirit, and this sort of patriotic ethos, it's perhaps a wrong word, but at the level, even though I see David smiling there, patriotic ethos, whether at the level of a particular organization, at one city, one's municipality, one's country, and so on. Maybe unpalatable to sort of committed cosmopolitans like you, but I submit that to you. Two, you have a principle that might tell us something like a sketch of a principle, how vigorously and through what means we should foster these norms, this ethos of equality, work, patriotism, and so on. For Mill, ultimately, there is some sort of rural utilitarianism that should guide us. But it seemed to me that you were willing to follow Mill part of the way, but not all the way to his very top principle, which should have been something like utilitarianism. For familiar reasons, not easy to reconcile with some of the things he says, but in your case it can't be something like utilitarianism. No doubt it should be something like the increase of the real freedom of occupational choice of those with least of it. But how will this translate in specific instructions remains very fuzzy, given the very uncertain effect of many of the things we do, given also the great difficulty of measuring the range of occupational choice, of having some sort of metric to know who is the person, who is the group with least opportunity choice. Can we in particular go further than simply some principle of the very vague principle of noblesse oblige? So some of you may remember that the only reference to an earlier version of the difference principle by John Rawls is a reference to Santayana's idea of a justified aristocracy, where the aristocracy could be justified if the noblesse oblige principle made the aristocrats, in fact, led them to do things which made the worst of the non and the ordinary folk better off than they would have been without the aristocracy. So isn't there something analogous here that applies to the talented, that it's just that what we should do ourselves and what we should educate our students to would be to come to the principle of noblesse oblige, to say you are privileged with all the talents which have taken you to university, made you succeed at university, you'll be well positioned in life, but part of your ethos must be to put these talents, these qualifications you have to the service of the community. Can we be any more specific than that? And finally, last, in the light of everything I said and remembering the various features of the example I gave at the beginning, should you feel bad about not becoming rector of Pompeu Fabra, and whether you feel bad or not, what should you do, Lana?